Sounds like I have a difficult job here.
So, James, would you like to take up the baton and answer it right here?
Thank you, Prime Minister. And I think that at the outset, you correctly pointed to the origins of the crisis. And Joe has expanded on that considerably. I would add one word and one framework of interpretation to that discussion of origins, and the word is fraud. I think it's important to recognize that at the root of the financial crisis, there was one of the greatest swindles of all economic history. The mortgages that were originated in the private sector in the United States, which were then transformed into securities and sold through the financial markets around the world, were in effect counterfeits. They were documents that looked like mortgages, but were known by the people making them to be certain to fail, to either have to be renegotiated or to default within a short period of time. They were made to borrowers who couldn't document their incomes, didn't have credit histories, on the basis of homes that whose values were grossly inflated by corrupt appraisers. These mortgages were laundered, counterfeit documents were laundered, in the technical sense of that term, money laundering, by the ratings agencies. That is to say, they were transformed from the triple B minus paper that they were into triple A paper. And then they were fenced, again, in the technical sense of that term, by the investment banks and the commercial banks, that is to say, sold onto the legitimate market massively, including massively to Europe, which is to say that the victims of this fraud include, to a very large extent, European investors, European pensioners, European funds, and European banks. It's important to recognize that this fact links the crises, the financial crisis in the United States and the sovereign debt crisis in Europe. Because what happened, in effect, when the fraud was exposed, which happened already in August of 2007, what happens with counterfeit documents is that they lose their value completely. No responsible investor will purchase them. A result of that, the interbank lending markets collapsed, and after a period of policy maneuvers that were intended to delay the inevitable, the financial markets themselves collapsed in September, October of 2008. And there was, in the panic, a flight to safety. The flight to safety is the origin of the sovereign debt crisis. And it is not a question of certain states having taken on the liabilities. Here I would differ with Joe's interpretation, the liabilities of the banking sector. It is an act of the world investment community attempting to get out of assets that they perceive to be relatively risky and into assets that they perceive to be relatively safe. The safest assets are the sovereign debts of the largest countries, especially the United States. And for that reason, yields on treasury bonds went down, reached practically historical lows, and the dollar has risen while the euro has fallen. And spreads between the large northern European countries and the smaller southern countries have rose dramatically from that date forward. And this problem was complicated by the innovation in the financial markets of the credit default swap, which is essentially a way to sell a bond that one does not own, that is to say, to short the bond market, transforming the debt markets for especially smaller and less liquid markets of smaller nations into highly volatile and speculative arenas, which they had not been before. That is probably an irreversible event, which needs to be taken into account in thinking about how to handle the crisis going forward, because it is now possible, and it has in fact happened, that groups of financial operators, hedge funds, and private equity funds and so forth, can and have made decisions to mount raids on the debt of smaller European countries, with the result that they drive down their prices and up their yields. The role of the governments who are caught up in this crisis, and I would especially cite the government of Greece in this case as having reacted in an exemplary way, is to face these difficulties with discipline, as effectively as possible under the circumstances, and above all, realistically. That is to say, without illusions, without pretending that things can be managed without pain and difficulty, but also without threats and without exaggeration, and without imposing cuts for theatrical purposes to impress a market that will not be impressed, or to inflict pain for the sake of inflicting pain, something which I believe is going on in the politics of the right-wing governments in other parts of Europe. It's a policy. What is required and what we are seeing in your government, Prime Minister, is a strong effort to seek original ways to preserve and advance the social agenda, to protect and improve the economic performance and the public administration of the country in the face of objective difficulties and very, very strong external pressures. And this is, I think, a mark of a serious and realistic approach for which your government is being recognized. What then is the responsibility of the larger community? It seems to me that the least that one can expect of the larger community in these circumstances is that it be equally realistic, that it approach this problem in a way which is pragmatic, that is consonant with the laws of economics and, frankly, with the laws of bookkeeping and national income accounting. And I've just mentioned three broad areas where it seems to me that it is very important that this principle be respected. First is in central bank policy. The Federal Reserve Bank in the United States, from the start of the crisis, took the view accurately that it had to provide liquidity if no one else was going to do so. And it effectively and very rapidly nationalized the commercial paper market and stabilized the money market funds, and in other ways provided, became the dealer of last resort in a money market, which is founded these days on the operations of dealers rather than the operation of banks. That action greatly contributed to the stabilization of the United States and to the current rising position of the dollar. In Europe, the central bank has been perhaps pragmatic in certain respects in its actions, but much more reluctant to recognize the necessity of those actions. And that has created a lot of uncertainty, which has affected the price of the sovereign debt of the smaller European countries. It is difficult for central banks to change policy and to recognize that the doctrines on which they were founded were fallacious, but it is sometimes necessary for them to do so, and it should be part of our agenda to explain this. So if it is now necessary, and I believe that it is necessary, for the European Central Bank or some other agency, such as a European debt agency, to provide a market for the sovereign debt of members of the European community, then so be it. That is now, it seems to me, a necessary feature of the scene, given the fact that the bond markets were destabilized by the intervention of large and speculative actors. And so we should recognize that this is now a permanent feature of the scene. A Rubicon has been crossed, cannot be crossed back in the other direction. Second point concerns the targets for budget consolidation or fiscal austerity. These targets, to the extent that they are necessary at all, should be set in a way which is realistically consistent with the resumption of economic growth and the and progress toward higher levels of employment. They should not be set in a way which is locked in by past practice or, let's say, a set of numbers written into the charter for reasons which are no longer relevant. If you ask the senior economic staff of the International Monetary Fund, and I have done this, why there should be a target of 3% for public budget deficits, and why there should be a target of 60% for the debt to GDP ratio, and why the targets should be implemented over a 5-year horizon, they don't know. If you ask them why it should not be 80% of GDP or 100% of GDP for the debt target, and why it should not be 2025 or 2050 rather than 2015 for the target date, they have no answer. Because there is no answer from the standpoint of any economic theory. It's one set of arbitrary and capricious rules. And of course, it is a fact that the harsher the austerity program, the more intrinsically unrealistic and incredible it is. The more intrinsically impossible it is to achieve the targets. Something that the credit markets understand very well. Again, the IMF's own studies show that half of the increase in budget deficits in the period since the crisis, fully half has been due to the collapse of revenues. A very large further share is due to negative growth in relation to previously existing debt burdens. Less than 10%, in fact, just 7.5% of the increase in public deficits in the advanced countries is due to discretionary fiscal stimulus, to the Keynesian policies. Less than 10%. So this is not a crisis caused by, or not a problem, not an issue caused by increase in discretionary public spending. It is an issue that is essentially an artifact of collapsing revenues. And if policies are pursued in such a way that foreclose successful return to economic growth, revenues will collapse further and the deficits will not go away. And it is clear that, for example, the leadership of the International Monetary Fund understands this very well. So one can ask, in discussions on this policy, for a degree of realism which has not been present before. Joe mentioned the longer run debt issue. And I want to just say a quick word about that. When you say we should focus on the longer run debt. My view is that debt to GDP ratios will rise. They will rise as a result of the crisis until the underlying cause of the crisis, which is the dysfunction of the financial sector, has been resolved. When a financial sector again exists, which is capable of performing the function of providing funds for business activity and for public investments, then the public debt to GDP ratio will fall. This is what happened in the United States after the Second World War, when the public debt to GDP ratio in 1946 peaked at 121% of GDP. And then it fell gradually to 33% of GDP by 1980, over time. Not because there was any great obsession with it, and certainly not because it was provoking any crisis. This was the period when the United States was the dominant force in the world economy. So our public debt to GDP ratio made no difference to the way the strength of our economy was perceived, but simply because we entered a very long period of largely privately financed economic growth. And that will happen again, and that will resolve the debt to GDP issue. Until it happens again, the debt to GDP issue would not be resolved. Third point, which is the question of imbalances between countries, largely an issue of current accounts. As a point of elementary realism, it should be recognized that within a balanced trading area, which the Eurozone is, the European Union largely is, a euro's worth of surplus in one country is a euro's worth of deficit in the other, in another country. This is a matter of bookkeeping. It is a matter of basic economic reality. It cannot be repealed by a call to higher levels of virtue. So long as the surpluses exist somewhere, the deficits have to exist somewhere else. Injecting an element of morality into this discussion is distinctly unhelpful. There is no greater virtue in surpluses and no greater vice in deficits. This simply reflects the different economic positions of the constituent countries of an economic area. And what is required here is that the surplus countries recognize that a stable and harmonious economy requires that surplus countries hold the debts of the debtor of the deficit countries. End of story. It is easy to see that there is no crisis, although there's a certain amount of grumbling about it, but there's certainly no crisis in the trade relations between the United States and China. China is a surplus country, but it holds the debts of the United States largely without complaining about it, and it does not try to tell the United States how to behave, which in any case would not succeed. And I'm just suggesting that within a community like the European Union, the same rules apply, and a reasonable and harmonious relationship similar to that between the U.S. and China ought to be the least that one should expect inside such an economic union. What then are the ultimate goals of a functioning community that tries to base its principles on realistic recognition of the economic realities? Many years ago, as a very young man, I was on the team that drafted the basic law governing the goals and objectives of economic policy in the United States. And this was ultimately enacted in 1978 as the Humphrey-Hawkins Act, formerly known as the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act. And the goals and objectives set by statute for the United States, including for the central bank, are full employment, balanced growth, and reasonable price stability. That phrasing is important. That phrasing, I submit, is reasonable and sets a set of objectives which is a coherent set of economic policy objectives with the emphasis in the right places. To replace such a standard with an objective entirely focused on accounting numbers, deficit numbers, and debt numbers would be both unrealistic and highly counterproductive. So the broad objectives should be, as always, full employment, balanced economic growth, reasonable price stability. And these should be achieved in our particular day and age in the context of addressing real problems, not invented ones. We have real problems. We have problems of energy and the environment. We have the problem of climate change. And I know, Prime Minister, your government has made this into a very important priority. We have the problem of caring for an aging population. We have the problem of educating a younger population so that it can continue to function effectively in a very demanding world. All of these activities require organization and resources, and they require also institutions capable of carrying them out. Historically, when countries have effectively tackled the need to construct and reconstruct themselves in a serious way, they have done so by constructing appropriate institutions. The United States did this in the New Deal by, first of all, taking Herbert Hoover's Reconstruction Finance Corporation and turning it into a large instrument of business finance that replaced what was not happening in the private banking sector, also spinning off institutions which created the modern American housing sector and much else besides. By specialized public institutions like the Tennessee Valley Authority, Rural Electrification Administration, and many others that set themselves the task of rebuilding the country. In post-war France, there were an entire host of specialized credit institutions, from the Caisse des dépôts et consignations, the Crédit Industriel et Commercial, the Crédit Agricole, Crédit Foncier, Crédit Hôtelier, a whole series of things whose purpose was to provide specific help to sectors of the economy that were deemed strategic or useful in the process of post-war redevelopment. And this succeeded in giving us the modern European state, in the case of France, similarly in Japan, similarly in Korea. And I would suggest that if we confront the reality of disorganization and essentially institutional failure in the private financial sector, that we should be thinking seriously at the level of the continental entities that we now have of the appropriate credit institutions for taking up this task and carrying it forward. And finally, there is a question of the relationship between entities, between regions, between countries in a larger community. Ultimately, over time, if a larger community is going to succeed, it is necessary that the less wealthy regions come together with the wealthier ones, that there be convergence in levels of income, prosperity, competitiveness. Not that one come to surpass the other, but that the gaps gradually narrow over time. This, too, is something with which we have concrete historical experience in the United States. The New Deal, inaugurated in 1933, is often thought of as a response to the Great Depression. But it was, in fact, a response, very much a response to the Civil War, to the failure of the Second American Confederacy, the Confederacy of the Southern States in 1865, and to the 7 decades of economic failure in the south of the United States that followed, leaving the southern United States immensely poor, backward, illiterate, malnourished, undeveloped. The New Deal provided the framework for the emergence of an American South which was fully integrated into a national economy that in fact did not exist before, and which could function as a successful and competitive part of that economy, to the point that now, 7 decades later, the American South is right at the average levels of the country as a whole. This is something which has to be part of an agenda for construction of a successful community. It is, of course, part of the European project all along, implemented in part by the structural funds, but certainly not to the point of adequacy and in a way which is greatly threatened by the present crisis. Preserving and advancing it seems to me to be a very, very crucial piece of the larger picture. And I also would suggest that it's an unavoidable piece because the problems of divergence simply get worse. The problems of divergence lead to migration. They lead to higher levels of conflict between the countries of the region, and ultimately they lead to the unthinkable. Since the unthinkable is unthinkable, I won't even mention it, but it seems to me that we all can see that there is a successful way forward and an unsuccessful way forward, and the successful way forward has to be consistent with basic social democratic values, with the basic values of human development, the basic values of economic development, the basic values of sustainability, both of the larger environment and of the economic community of which one would like to be part. Thank you very much.